Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 246, I had the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Nisha Acharya. We discuss her training route in uveitis, uveitis training and fellowships in the United States, and spend some time talking about the FAST study, looking at methotrexate and mycophenolate mofetil for the treatment of non-infectious uveitis. This important multi-center study had some great implications, and we can talk a little bit about uveitis trial design as well. Remember, you can claim CME credits for this episode and many other podcast episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. In addition, a list of financial disclosures will be listed in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Nisha Acharya. Dr. Acharya is a professor at University of California, San Francisco, where she works at the Proctor Foundation. She's the director of the Uveitis and Ocular Inflammatory Disease Service, as well as the Uveitis Fellowship at the Proctor Foundation. And she is one of the leaders in uveitis. We're going to talk a little bit about her career, her background in uveitis, and also a little bit about the FAST study, which we'll get into in a second. But first, Nisha, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So first question we always ask all new guests is, why did you choose ophthalmology and then why your field is so specialty? So for you, what was the specific reason you decided to pursue a career in uveitis?
That's a great question. I actually was not thinking about ophthalmology at all in medical school. You know, my only experience had been that I wore glasses and contacts. I really liked everything. And you know what happened, I don't know, I think it's in life sometimes we have fortuitous encounters. But as a first-year med student, and I was at UCSF as a med student, we got assigned to small group sections for our physiology course or class, and I got assigned to the eye. We didn't get to pick those. And that was actually run by an ophthalmologist, Emmett Cunningham, who many people know, who was a uveitis specialist at the time at UCSF. He was teaching it as a first year, and he was really captivating. He talked about how the eye works, like basic stuff about the eye, but because he was a uveitis specialist, he also introduced that and the whole idea of, you know, how inflammation and infection happens in the eye, how it's tied to the body. And I got really interested. And he basically said that any of us in the group could come to visit him in his lab or do research with him. And, you know, you have the summer off between first and second year. And so I took him up on that. And he was at the Proctor Foundation, and, you know, Proctor, I wasn't part of it at the time, but Proctor's always done a lot of global health work. And so I actually had the opportunity to go to India, to Aravind Eye Hospital, you know, as a med student because of Emmett. And I just, you know, I got super interested in that, and I got really turned on to ophthalmology. That being said, I still had a hard time when I was a fourth year committing to a field. But I think those initial exposures really struck with me. And so I was really happy to apply in ophthalmology. I had exposure and felt like it was the right field. But then ultimately in residency, I liked many things as well. But I think those, again, early exposures to uveitis that I had as an early med student had a pretty deep effect on me, because that's where I landed ultimately. That's what I do now.
So from there, you know, talking about your training and kind of I got a lot of questions sometimes from residents who are interested in uveitis. What sort of training path to take? Because there's people who do uveitis in retina. There's people who do uveitis more of an anterior kind of bend. Some people just do a general uveitis fellowship. In your case, after your residency at Mass Eye and you went on to do your fellowship at the Proctor Foundation, which was a joint fellowship in cornea and uveitis. How did you kind of make that decision in terms of deciding how to subspecialize within a subspecialty like uveitis?
Okay, yeah, so that's a good question. And things have changed over time, I would say, in terms of uveitis training. I was a resident at Mass Eye and Ear, and I was especially interested in cornea and cornea surgery and uveitis. But at that time, there were not AUPO-FCC specific fellowships. You know, there were just fellowships that people had. This was in 2004. So when you looked at fellowship, there were some kind of more combined fellowships. And the Proctor Fellowship at the time was a combined fellowship in cornea and uveitis. That's always how it had been historically. And so that really appealed to me. I wanted to be trained in all of uveitis, though. It's really important to me, to not just do anterior uveitis, because a lot of uveitis is actually more posterior segment. And some of the really interesting, challenging cases are. And that actually is most of my practice now. So I looked at programs, but I did have a cornea interest in the time. So I think, I tend to forget that now, but I really did. And so the Proctor program offered both. I ended up doing an extra year of fellowship, both to kind of get more training and also to learn more about clinical trials at, Genentech. So over the course of two years, I had enough time to learn both. That being said, I should just put out there for residents, and I'm very involved with the AUPO, Fellowship Compliance Committee now, things have changed so much in the field, right? Because now there's so much more to learn in each specialty. There's so many more cornea surgeries. There's so much in retina. There's so many more uveitis treatments. But now there are separate fellowships. And even at Proctor, we have a separate cornea fellowship from a uveitis fellowship. And I do want to say one thing. I know you introduced me kindly with saying I'm uveitis fellowship director, which I was for many, many years. And I recently passed on the torch to one of our other faculty, John Gonzalez, who was a fellow in uveitis with us. And we recruited back a few years ago, and he's been awesome. So I'm thankful to him for that. But back to kind of fellowship, I think it's whatever your interest is. If you just want to do uveitis, I think it's hard if you want to go into a private practice setting. And you don't want to do, if you just want to fill all your clinical time with uveitis, that's hard in a private practice setting. If you could at a university, if you had other roles, administrative or comprehensive, but many people, say, gosh, I like uveitis and I also like cornea, or I like retina. And I have seen that, it's become much more popular to do more than one fellowship, especially retina and uveitis, because a lot of uveitis, especially the really complicated cases, require, injections or surgical management, and now imaging. There's so much in retinal imaging. So I've seen I think we've seen a trend over the years that many of our fellows, including this year, we have a retina trained fellow who find it that if they do uveitis and retina, they can handle, they can handle everything that the patient has. But any of those options are fine. It just depends on ultimately what you want to be doing with your time.
And not to take this in a different direction, but I think it's interesting. We've talked a little bit about the subspecialization. This is kind of a microcosm of everything that's happened in medicine, right? Where we've gone from very general specialties to subspecialties within specialties. And now, because of the complexity and kind of the treatment options, you have subspecialties within subspecialties. So you have retinal specialists, for example, who specialize in oncology of the retina, and now you have uveitis specialists who are more of a specialty in posterior uveitis or anterior uveitis.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's so true.
Ultimate evolution, right? But, are there, when we talk from an educational standpoint, kind of looking at the medicine as a whole, do you think there are disadvantages to becoming subspecialized at some point? Or do you think this is more of an issue at academic institutions? Maybe not an issue, but more endemic and academic institutions where we kind of get the tertiary referrals and maybe it's okay that we're so subspecialized because we can kind of funnel those diagnoses into specific clinics.
Yeah, I think the only issue is that for uveitis, we have a shortage of uveitis specialists. There's not that many. There's like 12 to 14 uveitis fellowship programs per year. So we're not training, that many people. And so if you start, I think most of the uveitis fellowships out there all provide very comprehensive uveitis training, from anterior, intermediate, posterior pan uveitis, how to manage immunosuppression. That's one of the requirements of being an AUPO compliant, SCC compliant fellowship. We want fellows to have extensive training and to feel comfortable. But then from there, I think, it really depends on the fellow. I mean, if they're going to practice cornea and they do a cornea fellowship, it probably makes sense for them to do mostly anterior uveitis and cornea because, they may, that fits together better, right? Versus the retina specialist may not want to be seeing, all the GIA uveitis or just anterior cases. And so they may really prefer that. Problem is if you're in a place where there just aren't other uveitis specialists, if you're not willing to kind of see the breadth of uveitis, that there can be a gap in care, and we see this. And so I think if people have preferences, they can try to slant their practices a certain way, but I think it's really important for uveitis specialists to also try to go out there and use their skills fully, in whatever environment they are in.
Let's transition to talking about the FAST study, which was no pun intended, was not a FAST study to complete when you go read and kind of look at the history and how long that it took. So just to give the listeners some background, the FAST study was published in JAMA, and when I say JAMA, not JAMA Ophthalmology, but JAMA itself. There aren't that many ophthalmologists who can say they published a senior author in JAMA, but it looked at using mycophenolate mofetil, or brand name Celcept, or methotrexate for patients with uveitis. It was a randomized clinical trial. Do you want to give us a little background? I mean, this is a very ambitious project to undertake, kind of how you guys set out to design this trial, recruit patients, and then what you showed in terms of the outcomes.
Sure. Yeah. So, I really love clinical trials. I find that, that we have so many questions in uveitis that we don't have a lot of evidence to support what we do. It's just a lack of evidence, understudied field. We have a lot of case reports, retrospective studies. And so, a common question we face in practice, is when we have patients who have chronic uveitis and we want to start systemic immunosuppressive therapy, really had a lack of clinical trials to support what to do. We're most of us at the time, and it's changing slowly with biologics for sure, but still, most people for first line therapy, systemic therapy, when you need something beyond steroids, which we want for chronic uveitis, people use anti-metabolites, and methotrexate and mycophenolate mofetil or Celcept are really commonly used around the world. Methotrexate has been used longer, it's really inexpensive, it's widely available. Once a week drug, side effect profile, it has side effects, but it's been used for so many decades that it's considered a pretty safe drug overall. But then mycophenolate came along, it's much more expensive, it's 5 to 6 times more expensive, and there's a lot of interest in it. And so we were using both of these drugs off-label, and the perception from the literature and among people that I knew was that mycophenolate mofetil was better in terms of just being able to achieve steroid-sparing control and a better drug for uveitis. But when I really looked at the data, there was very limited data. There's just retrospective studies, and the methotrexate doses were really low in those studies. And it was such a heterogeneous population. It was really hard for me to compare. And so I just wanted to answer a really bread and butter question is, when you're going to start immunosuppressive therapy, which one of these does better at 6 and 12 months, at achieving steroid sparing control in patients who have active, non-infectious, intermediate posterior pan uveitis. So this is uveitis affecting the posterior segment, which is usually, the patients that need chronic immunosuppressive therapy. So it's really a head-to-head comparative effectiveness trial. I did want to mask all the outcomes because I think uveitis trials are sometimes, we have subjective outcomes with measurement of inflammation. So I wanted all the ophthalmologists and visual acuity measure, and OCT, all of that to be done in a masked manner. And so really patients with active uveitis, and we had a lot of criteria, but basically there has to be a justification for starting a steroid-sparing immunosuppressive therapy. And they were randomized. So it was a trial of 216 patients, and half the patients were randomized to methotrexate, half to mycophenolate mofetil, and the primary outcome was 6 months. It was steroid-sparing control. We actually only wanted the steroids. So they were all on a prescribed prednisone taper. We followed the standardization of uveitis nomenclature, standard guidelines for steroid tapering. We wanted the level to go down to 7.5 milligrams to achieve, that's considered steroid sparing. It's not off, but it's kind of a medically acceptable dose at 6 months, and controlled inflammation in all parts of the eye. So anterior chamber, vit haze, retinal choroidal inflammation, OCT, some other imaging studies that we had per, different diseases. We had guidelines on what should be done, fluorescein, et cetera. So it wasn't like the typical, drug pharmaceutical trial where, the FDA just looks at one endpoint or vit haze. In life, in practice, we care about inflammation in all parts of the eye. So we had a very I would say clinically meaningful endpoint, that I think is something that we all look for. It's a hard goal to have that, that much control of inflammation and to get the steroids down by 6 months. But that was the idea. I've always, I've done global health work now, right? Since I've been at Proctor for a long time and we do international trials. I believe that it actually is a good thing to have diversity in your patients, in trials, because it adds to the generalizability. It's tougher in many ways, to manage the trial and ensure that standards are met across sites. But we planned this trial, originally we planned this trial just to be UCSF, Oregon, the PC Eye Institute, and then Aravind Eye Hospital System, which we've done a lot of work with in South India. And then just when we were ready to get started up, and this is you're alluding to, it's not a fast trial. Well, we had just started, and then that was when the Indian government put a hold on all clinical trials in like any trial in their country. And that was nothing to do with us, right? It was related to some HIV studies, and there were some issues with, you know, who was enrolled, and people were complaining, you know, that there wasn't good consent, and they were sort of taking advantage of some of these patients. So anyway, everything was on hold, NIH put a hold on trials, and we got set back quite a bit. I was really worried. But fortunately, NIH was so great about this. They said, you know, this is still an important question. You got funded. It went through, you know, peer review. So just hopefully India will get back, you know, up and running, right? Eventually, these regulations will be sorted out. But why don't you expand to other centers? And so that gave me the opportunity to, you know, we started in the U.S. and we added a couple centers. We also expanded to Saudi Arabia, KCASH, Mexico City, and we had a collaborator there. And Australia was a really big collaborator, actually, at the Royal Eye and Ear Victorian Hospital with Lindell Lim. So they were really excellent collaborators. So, and then finally, we were lucky India did come back on board. You know, it was almost like a year and a half or so. So we definitely, you know, they were the ones that we had planned to work with, and they were all set up. So we were really thankful when they were able to come back on board, but it definitely delayed, you know, it just slowed it down a bit, but we were able to enroll in about 4 years or so, and then there's a year of follow-up. So, you know, we finished the trial, and one thing about the trial, so I think I mentioned primary outcome, 6 months, steroid-sparing control. If patients are a treatment success, then they stay on that same drug for another 6 months, so we're able to get 12-month outcome. If they fail in the first 6 months, then they switch drug, and the outcomes are still all masked. You know, the doctor doesn't know which drug they were on first or second. So they switched to the other drug. And that part was to really look at the utility of, if you fail one of these anti-metabolites, how useful is it to really try the other one, you know, or should you just go to some other types of medicines or local therapy, for instance. So we found for our primary outcome that there was that methotrexate achieved that 67% of patients are randomized to methotrexate were a treatment success at 6 months versus 57% on mycophenolate. So about a 10% difference favoring methotrexate. That did not reach a superiority threshold for statistical significance. We were not powered to find a 10% difference in superiority. We were powered to find a 20% difference with a sample size of 216. So, you know, p-value was small, but did not reach statistical significance for the overall analysis. However, we had pre-specified a few sub-analyses, which were pre-specified. You know, they were written down. We had to commit to them. And those included doing, one of them was doing a sub-analysis in the posterior pan uveitis subgroup compared to the rest, which were the intermediate. And we have many more patients in posterior pan uveitis. And that's like, you know, the most severe type of uveitis. And that was a pre-specified subgroup, and that actually did come out significantly in favor of methotrexate. So 74% of patients with posterior pan uveitis on methotrexate achieved steroid-sparing control versus about 55% on mycophenolate. So, you know, almost a 20% difference there, and that p-value was 0.02. So that was interesting, and I think kind of, you know, interesting to see. The other thing is we had also declared a formal that we would, if we did not find superiority of one drug, superiority, that we would test if one drug was not inferior to the other, just so that we could, you know, statistically say it's not inferior. And so methotrexate definitely highly statistically significantly not inferior to, you know, mycophenolate mofetil, which is expected given that it was almost superior overall. You know, it was 10% better. It definitely was not worse. So, and then just in terms of other findings, I think that are important to point out, you know, the 12-month data was about the same. If you were a success at 6 months, you were very likely to be a success at 12 months with tapering off the steroids. So we allowed a taper from 7.5 to 0 in the second 6 months. And then what was really interesting also is for patients who switched therapy, that was another significant result where patients who switched from mycophenolate to methotrexate did very well, actually. They had almost a think almost 70% chance of succeeding, 69 to 70%, versus the other way around. If you failed methotrexate and switched to mycophenolate, it was quite a low, it was very low, well below 50% of those succeeded. So, you know, I think those are obviously secondary analyses. They were pre-specified. So, you know, you kind of have to decide how you want to interpret them. But, you know, overall, the trial result is that there's not a significant difference between drugs and methotrexate is definitely not inferior. And the side effect profile, there wasn't really much of a difference. There were more non-serious side effects in terms of like non-serious liver function elevations with methotrexate, and then more dose reductions with methotrexate than mycophenolate due to intolerability, but nothing in the way of, I mean, we had a small number of serious adverse events, and they were equal between treatment groups. Mostly liver function tests, an extremely low number. So I think, you know, my take-home messages are that you have two drugs. I think you should feel comfortable using either drug because technically, you know, they're not significantly different. But personally, you know, I see a few signals in there that methotrexate looks better. And I think that the cost difference is tremendous. In the U.S., you know, these are off-label drugs, right? They're not, you know, and so we sometimes do fight with insurance, especially for the more expensive drug, mycophenolate. We often get denials. So mycophenolate for the Red Book cost, and I think in 2018, you know, methotrexate for our full dosing is about 200 something a week. And a month. So, you know, less than $300 a month. And mycophenolate, mofetil is like $1,600 a month. So, you know, it's quite a bit, 5 to 6 times more. And this is especially true in developing countries, right? Like India or other countries, you know, it's really same cost difference. I mean, the drug costs are a little different, but mycophenolate is expensive everywhere. So I think people should feel comfortable using the cheaper drug. And I think this, I think kind of, you know, a lot of people I've talked to who wrote some of the retrospective studies, they believe that maybe the retrospective studies showed a different outcome, because if you look, the methotrexate dosing was quite low in those. People were afraid of intolerability, and a lot of those are like 15 milligrams, 10 milligrams. And we really, our strategy was you go up high and then you do dose reductions if you have intolerability. But you go up high, like at two weeks, we went up to the full dose of both drugs. So that's sort of, that's in a nutshell what it is. I think it was really meant to be a practical trial to guide our initial therapy of, you know, when you want to use systemic therapy.
You know, in terms of the study, I think it's a fascinating study. You went through a lot of the really important take-home points. And I kind of tie it back to what we teach, you know, residents, fellows, and in reality, what we're teaching the general ophthalmologist out there who is not taking care of these patients, prescribing these drugs, but what they kind of think of these two medications. Same mm-hmm. class of drug. Definitely a huge cost difference, like you referred to. And one of the things that's often referred with methotrexate is, well, patients do better with mycophenolate or CellCept because, you know, it's better tolerated. There's less GI side effects with it. And really, this study, if you talked about the side effects, there was a mild difference in terms of liver function elevation. But in terms of intolerability, it was slightly higher in the methotrexate group, but it wasn't a significant percentage with the statistical analyses. It's nice to have the flexibility to use both medications. I do think it's interesting, though, that I think the cost savings is really a huge thing to take home, because as you referenced, some of the study was done in other countries, and depending on where you are in the world, that cost difference can be substantial. And there's also, as you said, the actual logistical concerns of having a patient have to take a medication daily versus an injection once a week. So I do think this is interesting. So have you altered, and you kind of referenced, have you altered sort of your practice patterns for how you utilize these medications?
Yeah, I mean, I think our investigators all thought mycophenolate was going to be better too. You know, they did. They were like, we were shocked. In some of our countries, they would actually like really make patients pay for this, you know, because, I mean, prior to the study, right? Because they would think, especially for posterior pan uveitis or for the worst uveitis, they would make them pay a lot of money for it because they just thought that, okay, we got to give them that drug. And so I think now, yeah, I start with methotrexate, you know, so there's a few caveats. So methotrexate, you know, I think if somebody's a really big drinker, I probably wouldn't start them on it. Although I will tell you, our Australian colleagues in this trial, and they had a good number of patients, they kind of have a don't ask, don't tell policy, and there weren't that many issues. But, you know, I would probably say that if somebody drinks daily or many times a week, You know, they probably shouldn't be on it, even though we monitor liver function tests. And then, you know, if somebody, but I would start with methotrexate. And, you know, if somebody has a really bad intolerability, you can always switch or move on to many other treatment options that we have in uveitis now. But I think it's a reasonable drug to try. I do. And I also think if you do start mycophenolate, you shouldn't, it's fine, but you might not want to, you might want to consider going to methotrexate if things aren't going well, and at least give that a try. Because, you know, it's a cheap, inexpensive, or inexpensive, widely available drug. It's once a week. And I should mention, you know, we did oral treatment. We did oral methotrexate and oral mycophenolate, but, you know, subcutaneous methotrexate is probably better tolerated and better bioavailability, at least from the rheumatology literature. And so the efficacy might have been even better, right? Probably expected to be better. And so that's an option as well. I think that, I mean, we didn't study it, so I can't say that definitively, but given everything we know about the drug, metabolism and bioavailability, I think the results would be expected to be even better with it. So for me, it is a game changer in terms of, I feel now, you know, I start with it.
Let's just end, you know, and we spent a lot of time talking about the fast study, which is perfect. I just want to end with a quick kind of question, which is a very complex question that maybe there's some simple kind of guiding principles. So I think a very common question from retina providers who are in areas, as you said, where there's a shortage of uveitis specialists and they're managing patients is, how do I decide whether I'm using local therapy or systemic therapy when treating a patient with uveitis, right? So sometimes retina specialists are more comfortable with local therapies, like a subtenon's injection of a steroid or an intravitreal injection of a steroid. But maybe the patient would do better with systemic treatment. And we have a couple of trials you might reference that kind of look at this question. But how do you kind of subdivide it when you see a patient, right? So obviously certain conditions are going to behave differently, but in general, does unilaterally versus bilaterally play a role? Let's say there's no other systemic disease. So let's say it's simply a bilateral uveitis, the negative systemic workup. How do you kind of divide in your head whether you're going to approach a patient from a local approach or a systemic approach?
It's a really important question and continues to be, I think, an issue for everyone to think about and is evolving. So all of those points you raised are excellent, right? I don't think there's one right way, first of all, and I'm really thankful that we have more and more options of both local therapy and systemic therapy for uveitis, because we need them, because every patient's different, every condition's different, condition's not the same in every patient. Every patient reacts differently. So I think it's really important for us to have it. And I always tell patients that even if we start with one approach, we may switch, you know, or we may need to switch to another systemic drug or go local. So I tell them about all the different approaches so that they're aware. I don't want to be biased and only presenting, you know, one possibility for them. So my take, so I do have a strong belief though that there are some types of uveitis that are chronic, you know, and chronic doesn't mean forever, but it means for years. And there's a list of these, you know, in our publications in uveitis and the guidelines for the use of immunosuppression paper by Doug Jabs et al. You know, there's a list of diseases, and those are things like birdshot and retinal vasculitis and BKH and sympathetic ophthalmia, multifocal choroiditis, you know, serpiginous, there's a whole bunch, right? Those tend to be chronic or really highly recurrent chronic, and they tend to be the posterior pan uveitis, so they're pretty devastating in terms of their potential to have vision loss. The issue with just doing local therapy in those conditions is that it may work for a while, right? But then you never know that when the next flare is going to be. Right. And a lot of these steroids are short acting. Yeah. And so then the problem is if you treat after you have the inflammation, you already have some damage every time you're accumulating damage, you know, in the retina with that new retinal lesion, right? Or you may hit the macula or you have more vasculitis. And so even though you're treating, it's a response to already having this increase in inflammation, and you get this, it's this whole concept of having cumulative damage in the eye. And so that is problematic. And I see that a lot. And I get a lot of referrals of patients who've had intermittent steroid injections, and then eventually they have a lot of damage. And, you know, there's a need to kind of think about other options. So systemic therapy, the idea is it prevents, it just, you know, if you find the right drugs, right? And there's many, we have biologics, we have anti-metabolites, we do combinations. But if you find something that controls inflammation, then you have a nice even suppression when you're on it, right? And so, but I do want to point out some good things about local therapy. So, you know, to that point, I think for chronic inflammatory diseases, I think systemic therapy provides nice continuous even immunosuppression. And the MUSC trial, which I think, you know, probably everyone's seen now by now, but the multi-center uveitis steroid treatment trial, It's a great trial funded by the NIH, led by Doug Jeff, John Kempen, Jen Thorne, and others. You know, and we were really, I've been involved with it along with many uveitis specialists. Really looked at a longer term steroid implant, the fluocinolone acetonide or Retisert implant that lasts, you know, almost three years versus systemic therapy, and looked at how it worked in terms of inflammation control, vision, et cetera. And outcomes were really similar in terms of there was no difference in vision, you know, in vision at 3 years, 5 years, but they had long term follow up, which came out a couple of years ago. They looked at 7 year outcomes, and it was at 7 years that they found that outcomes were better in patients who were on systemic immunosuppressive therapy. Now, people have different interpretations on that, but I'll just give you my opinion since I think I'm allowed to do that. You know, the take home message there is that systemic therapy did better, right? Long term than implant therapy. But if you look at the details, you know, the people on implants, the patients on implants, the median time to reimplantation was about more than 5 years. And so there was a delay in reimplanting patients who were initially randomized to the implant. And it wasn't required to reimplant. It was not required. It was investigator discretion. So there's a tendency with steroids, with injections and implants, to not just do it on a set schedule, but to kind of be like, okay, maybe the patient's doing great. Let's just wait and see. Maybe they won't have a recurrence. And then you get inflammation starting and building. And this points to the principle of,
And just to interrupt, but this could kind of feed in discussion, but does part of this, and you referenced when you designed the study, how you have to measure inflammation, right?
Yeah.
Part of this is our ways of measuring inflammation. Maybe if there was a way to detect inflammation at a subclinical level before, because if you're constantly, like you said, chasing, you know, the tail, then you're never quite avoiding the damage that happens from recurrent inflammation, right? And then if most of us aren't inclined, as you said, to use steroids given the side effect profile as a preventative,
that's kind
of
a big one too.
Standard measure, right? So
yeah,
it maybe if we had better ways, people have talked about, for example, anterior segment OCT or other sort of things to kind of quantify inflammation before it's sort of full blown, maybe that would be helpful as well. And that's probably one of the things that'd be incorporated more into studies, correct?
I agree. There needs to be a lot of work with that. I think that's the future. I think we don't even know how to, you know, do that well. I mean, like OCTA, right? Or adaptive optics, or, I mean, we're already doing, you know, EDI, but there's different ways. I think we need to go much further there because, yes, if you could, in principle, find those early changes, right, you could be able to intervene. And, of course, the steroid side effect profile needs to be, you know, dealt with. But in general, there's things being developed, right, that maybe would have a better side effect profile but be local therapy. You really want to have it on board before you see, you know, before you see that inflammation really manifest, you know, where it's too late, right? And then the other question is there ongoing continual inflammation in some of these conditions, like birdshot? Is there some level of subclinical choroidal inflammation going on, you know, if you don't treat? And so do you really just need a continuous therapy? There are a lot of questions, I think, that need to be answered. But I agree with you. I think that if we had better abilities to detect subclinical inflammation, we would be able to intervene sooner. But I think steroids, local therapy is so useful, and we still depend on it in uveitis. Macular edema, I think steroids in the eye are still the best things we have, any of the steroids in the eye. We often need it. You know, the MUST trial, the majority of patients, even on the systemic arm, needed adjunctive injections to treat macular edema. And that's something that I see in practice all the time. So I think, but you know that if the patients that are on, so data does show that if you're on systemic immunosuppressive therapy, the CME is less likely to recur if you give a local steroid injection, right? So there's still a benefit. Steroids help, or systemic therapy helps to just control the underlying inflammation, but sometimes it's not enough and we need adjunctive therapy. And then also, you know, if there's patients who have disease that recurs very infrequently and it's unilateral and no systemic disease, sure, and they don't like systemic therapy or contraindications, or they don't like the experience on it, or they've tried it, it's really great to have local therapy options, and you're seeing more and more of those being developed, right, with longer-term options. And we'll have to see how those pan out, but I'm glad to see that those are, you know, are being studied and are coming out into use.
Dr. Charia, we went over time, and I apologize for taking up more of this great discussion, and congratulations again to your team. I don't think we're past the statute of limitations to congratulate you, especially in the COVID-19 world.
Thank you.
We got to be appreciative of these multi-centered kind of international studies that a lot of which are ongoing have been halted. And one of the ripple effects that no one's talking about is kind of the research effects of what this does for research and trials. So thank you again for your time. Hope you guys are safe on the West Coast. And our listeners, we're really happy to hear from you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 246 episodes can be found there sorted by category. In addition, you will have links to subscribe and get updates on the most recent episodes. Those updates can be mailed to your email inbox. I prefer to get my updates on my mobile device, so I've subscribed via the Apple Podcast app on my iPhone. You can do similarly if you have an Android device in the Android Podcast app. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. And if you have episode ideas or feedback, feel free to reach out. Our email is retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much to those of you who leave reviews. Those are extremely helpful as we move forward. Thank you to Dr. Nisha Acharya for her time for today's episode. Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chain, Dr. Mike Benacasa for their help with the production and social media for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.